All right, so we'll start the Q&A portion of the evening. Just a little rundown of how that's going to work. We have two wireless microphones that will circulate the audience. We have Margo and Sarah both have one of our microphones. So you will flag one of them down. They'll come hand you the microphone so you can ask your question. You'll get your response, and we'll continue moving on. We tend to cycle between the upper section and the lower section. We alternate back and forth. So if you have your hand up and they see you but don't come right away, it's probably because they're waiting to go back and then forth. So they see you. Don't be offended if they don't come to you right away. We'll get you up. So any questions about the questions? I don't know. So Margo and Sarah will find our questions, and I'll turn it back over to you.
This doesn't have too much. I came late, so it doesn't have too much to do with the color blue, but I've always been curious about monarch butterflies. Are they the only ones who migrate, and why? And secondly, if you put a bunch of monarch butterflies in Europe, what would they do?
All very good questions. So we do see migration-like behavior in other butterflies. One that we know does a lot of long-distance movement is one called the Painted Lady. We have those around here. Those are not circular movements. They're not kind of return voyages. They're just large population movements. So when they run out of flowers or nectar in a certain area, the whole population will kind of pick up. So you can think of them as being more nomadic than migratory. But they can be really large groups of butterflies, so much so that people have to stop their cars because they can't see. I'm not exactly sure why monarchs do it. That's a very difficult thing to get at because it's happened so long ago in time that it's very difficult to recreate the circumstances that might have resulted in that. And that's a chronic problem in biology. When you have something that's singular like that, it's very difficult to figure out what might have started it in the first place. If you were to, at a wedding in France, release a bunch of monarchs, they would be, number one, very confused because they only speak English and Spanish. But number two, I'm not sure what they would do. They do use magnetic cues to try to navigate. Depending on which population they come from, if they come from the Northeast or from the Pacific Northwest, they have different migratory routes. So they might actually attempt to trace those kinds of magnetic cue routes through Europe and down into Africa, but they would be at a complete loss, really. I think they would have a hard time. Obviously, they wouldn't end up in Mexico. No, unfortunately not. And one of the challenges of the monarch butterfly is that it is so specific to where it goes and overwinters that you couldn't try to reproduce that situation anywhere else in the world. Once we lose that wintering ground, they're gone. That's why they're at such risk. So it didn't used to be. It used to be a much larger area, but that area has shrunk as people have removed the forest habitat that's really critical for them to be able to overwinter. The forest situation is one that protects the temperatures that they need in order to not dehydrate or get too cold over the course of the winter, because it is Mexico, but it still gets cold. So,
I was wondering how diet influences colors. Does it influence colors at all in butterflies?
Absolutely. So this is one of the major things that my lab studies. These pigments oftentimes require basic resources that they use to build the rest of their bodies. And so when they don't have a lot of high-quality nutrition as caterpillars, the adult bodies they build are compromised, and they end up facing trade-offs between how well their immune system functions, for instance, how big their brains are, how large their body is. And these pigments oftentimes, and to some extent those structures, like that UV structure that I showed you, are affected by that process. And so they, if you can think of these colors as being investment and the ability to mate, they have to balance that investment against investment in things like surviving the plague, right? You know, butterflies are actually quite prone to disease. We worry about it every day, disease in the lab, worry about outbreaks of disease. So butterflies have a lot of things to juggle, and colors are amongst them. And all of that stems from what they're able to get as caterpillars. That's the most critical phase for getting their nutrition.
Questions? So the first is, what are there sex differences in within a species in color perception? And how does this vary with, I guess, the range or variability of colors that a male can take on, or the patterning?
Yeah. That's a great question. And the answer is yes. In the cabbage white, for instance, we know that male and female eyes function differently, which is something of a surprise. It's only with very careful study that we've been able to detect that. And so the male eye has pigments that in it that filter the light, like sunglasses, that the females do not have. And that changes the perception of color for the two different sexes. People have speculated that it helps males and females to better discriminate the colors that are important to them. So, for instance, maybe it helps the female, their eyes help them evaluate male colors better than males might be able to evaluate male colors. We really don't know. At the moment, they're kind of just-so stories. But actually, the sulfur butterflies, a paper just came out a week ago from the same group that we collaborate with in Japan, showing that group of butterflies also have differences between males and females in the way their eyes work. And so that's a relatively unexplored area. Males and females, because of the different priorities they have as adults, they experience very different environments. Females are oftentimes down in amongst the plants laying eggs, and they're moving more slowly. Males are moving very rapidly trying to identify females, oftentimes at much higher heights in the environments that they're in. And so even just the differences in behavior and the locations they are inhabiting and in their environments may explain to some extent why their eyes work differently.
I guess I have a follow-up question to that.
So, mm-hmm.
Sorry. So you mentioned that there are sex differences. So are males, like, does their ability to perceive color, does that differ with the range? So let's say they can see a female, like other male butterflies, differences within other male butterflies. Does that affect the way they like perceive their chances of mating with a female based on like other like the competition that they're getting?
Yeah, so I think that males absolutely are keeping track of the competition. I'm not joking. I mean, we see this a lot. We see this in a wide variety of animals, that males will adjust their effort and their investment in mates in relation to their perceived competition. I'm not sure I can't think off the top of my head how that might help us to understand how their eyes work, but it certainly helps us to understand their behavior. And it also helps us to understand how they invest in those large packages of nutrients. So we might expect that males that think that they are the last butterfly on the planet might actually invest slightly less in those because they feel like they're at lower risk of having that female mate again. Whereas males that perceive there being loads of suitors lined up waiting for her next mating might invest more heavily in those spermatophores. Number one, to try to monopolize her reproductive output. But number two, because they realize they're in heavy competition and they may actually have lower chances of mating with other females as well. Does that help? Yeah.
So I had a whole separate question initially. And I was just wondering, you talked about adult butterflies and the color variation within them. And I was wondering about the color variation within for caterpillars, like at earlier stages, and how that, I suppose, affects what that might derive from, like whether there are different mechanisms that might be underlying that.
Yeah. So one key difference there is that, of course, caterpillars are not interested in sex. So we throw out all of those questions almost immediately, but there are a lot of selective pressures, we would say, in kind of evolutionary biology speak, that are important for the color you are as a caterpillar. And I showed you that picture of those red caterpillars and black caterpillars, and we see that kind of variation in some populations. Some of that has to do with their thermal budget, so caterpillars want to be hot, but not too hot, so that their development proceeds rapidly, but they don't, of course, want to desiccate or cook. So it depends on where they're positioned, where their mother laid their egg to some degree. We also see changes over time. So there are really nifty butterflies that have caterpillars that start out looking like little green things, and then at one molt, they switch to looking like a bird dropping. Once they're big enough to be really obvious, they turn into an appearance that makes them look completely unattractive to bird predators, right? And so we're beginning to understand some of the developmental mechanisms that allow for that really large shift in color. But our understanding of the reasons why caterpillars are colored the way they are fairly rudimentary. I mean, a lot of it feels very intuitive. Oh, they're green or they're brown because it makes them more difficult to see. But you'd be shocked at how little work there is out there on that kind of question. So I think everybody assumes we know it because it seems so obvious what the answer would be, but in terms of actually going out and measuring it, we have very little there. I've worked with a team of biologists on the woolly bear caterpillar. People know that, right? The woolly bear caterpillar. It's a little fuzzy thing, and you might see it. People often say, oh, well, it'll tell you what kind of winter you're going to have, depending on the size of the bands. That actually turns out not to be true. Although it does have to do with the thermal budget, right? So the amount of black you have is important for how warm you are as those caterpillars. But as it turns out, the ones with the biggest orange bands do the best at deterring bird predators. So there's this tension between thermoregulation, how warm your body is, and how likely you are to get eaten, that creates a lot of variation there, which is why there's enough variation to have a wives' tale about it. But that's some of the first work that's really started to look at those kinds of questions. So.
Okay, so that is a myth, that the color, the thickness of the coat and the color of it has more to do with deterring birds away from them rather than the predicting what the winter's going to be like? No, it is the opposite. Instead of it being predicting what the winter's going to be like, it is actually to deter or to scave off birds.
Right, exactly.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely.
Learned that tonight.
To some degree, what the fall has been like, actually. Okay. So I apologize for anybody who's been anticipating their winter wardrobe based on those.
I am.
It'll tell you whether or not you got your fall wardrobe correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
A question I had was about spiders in particular, about those odd-looking eyes and why they always have eight. And I actually had a second one about it, was since I noticed that some of those kind of point up, like, does that give them the ability to see in all directions? And what does that say about the organization or their brain if they can see like a planetarium?
I encouraged him to ask this. He wasn't sure if I would answer spider questions at a butterfly talk. Yeah, so one of the things that we find, and one of the things that's most compelling to me about studying these animals or studying the way that their eyes work, is that they don't have the advantage of our large body size. So we can have pretty good eyes, actually. The bigger you get, the bigger eye you can carry around, and the better it can do. I mean, if you look at the difference between a little point-and-shoot and a big digital SLR, you can get a sense for why that might be important. And so these small animals face a lot of really important trade-offs in what's important about the visual world that they encounter. What are the key pieces of information they need to get from the lit world around them? And one of the solutions is to make a bunch of eyes that have different functions. So instead of trying to make one eye that does a great job of everything, which is really quite impossible if you're that size, you make four pairs of eyes, each of which is good at something, but all together make for a good visual system. And so for these animals, where's my pointer here? For these animals, we're mostly studying these eyes here. And these eyes are extraordinary eyes. I wish I'd thrown some extra slides in here. They actually work like Galilean telescopes. The only camera eyes that we know from any small terrestrial invertebrate like this. So they have eyes like ours. They actually have the same kind of acuity or the same level of acuity or ability to discriminate pattern in the world around them as a pigeon. Right? Remarkable for an animal that's about 4 millimeters big as its whole body is. And these eyes are teeny, teeny, tiny. But they have a number of compromises. One is that their retina is itsy-bitsy. So although this lens can focus light from a pretty wide range of space, the retina can only see a very tiny fraction of that. So it really is acting like a telescope. But fortunately for them, that retina actually has muscles that move it around, like a telescope on a little tripod. So they can actually change where they look without you knowing. They can actually move the retinas around in their head to see different areas of space. This is where their color vision is. These eyes here seem to be mostly motion and shape detection. And the ones, there's two pairs on the back of the head, which you can't see. One pair in this group of spiders is vestigial. They're not really seeing much. And the other is likely to be also for motion detection, to see things that are creeping up from behind them, and also potentially for navigation. So what they've done is they have, and those eyes are not camera eyes. Those eyes act very differently. So they don't have very good resolution. They're just able to see things that move quickly. The other kind of crazy thing about these eyes here is that they have 4 layers to their retina, and they actually, you can, if you want to be mean to these animals, you can paint black all of their eyes but one of these, and they're still able to judge distance and reliably capture prey. And the reason for that is that they actually have depth perception within the eye. And they do that by looking at the difference in focus, how focused the image is between 2 different retinal layers. So when it's focused in one but not focused in another, that gives them a rough estimate for the distance of the objects. So incredible, extraordinary innovations in these eyes that enable them to do really unique things with a very small real estate. And so I think we see these kinds of clever miniaturization solutions in these kinds of animals. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, so the neurobiology of these animals is really in a kind of in its early stages. Obviously, they've got, you know, we have a hard enough time paying attention to what our 2 eyes give us, and then you dial that down by, you know, several million neurons at least, right? So you got a brain that can fit into this head in amongst these big eyes, and now you've got a problem, right? So one of the challenges is to try to understand how they process all of this information, and they almost certainly have to ignore some of it. But they do seem to be using them all simultaneously. But we don't really, people are very curious about how they are able to extract complex information with such simple neurons and eyes. And it's quite remarkable. The research on this stuff, they use different hunting tactics for different kinds of prey items so they can determine who they're hunting and use a totally different strategy depending on what it is. They do detouring, they do all sorts of tactical things with, you know, a brain tiny, you can't see with the naked eye, right? So pretty extraordinary.
When in our backyard, we have a fair number of butterflies, but can we assume right off the bat that 50% are male and 50% are female?
No. the reason for that is because if you're looking at them on your flowers, it depends. Depends on what your backyard is like. If it's mostly plants that don't have flowers but that females like to lay eggs on, then it's probably mostly female butterflies. But if you're just looking at flowers and what butterflies visit flowers, it's very strongly male biased. And the reason for that is that males have a much higher energy requirement as adults because they're spending so much time trying to find females that they need to visit flowers much more often. And it's actually a challenge. When we begin studying a new species of butterfly in the lab, it's difficult to figure out exactly where the females are. They're much more concentrated on laying eggs, so they're much more concentrated on the host plants that their caterpillars will feed on. And it's much easier to find the males because they're concentrated around flowers where they're kind of tanking up on nectar water. So it's you will have some females there, but I would guess that it's mostly males.
So do the males know where they're going to go to find the females, or they happen upon them and then the female goes, bad wings, go get away from me?
Well, they know where the females are much better than we do, usually. yes, I mean, they are pretty good at identifying where females are. Actually, in many butterfly species, males set up little territories and corridors of high female activity. So they're guarding corridors of female movement. So they do seem to know where females are in the environment. In some butterfly species and other insect species, they adopt conventions about where they'll meet. They're kind of crazy. There's a phenomenon called hilltopping, which when I was in Arizona, I spent a lot of time kind of being wowed by animals that would had just decided to meet at the tops of hills at the end of the day. That is where they had evolved to meet up. And males would vociferously defend territories up at the tops of hills, whether it be a bush or a rock outcrop. And females, when they were ready to mate, would just go up and visit. And the male that had the highest territory, the kind of king of the mountain, usually won. So there are kind of weird, you know, conventions that help some butterfly species find each other. And the ones that I talked about, most of those, at least the first group, they're what are called scramble competitors. So that means that the males are they're on a race against time. They're going to areas where females might be emerging, or where females may be laying eggs and hoping to run into females, and then hoping that those females either have not mated yet or have mated long ago enough in time to be ready to mate again. So.
Can I ask one
more
question? I don't want to hold your mic.
It's fine
with me. Are there some females who don't make the grade either? Or can any female always find a...
Well, it depends on the species, but in general, males are less choosy. males do pay attention to females and to aspects of female quality. They're particularly interested in female size because that has something to do with how many eggs she can lay. So we do see that males are making decisions based on... when they're given choices, they make decisions based oftentimes on female size, sometimes on female color as well. But when they're not given a choice, if it's female or no female, the answer is always female. Yeah. Sound familiar?
What is the biggest butterfly you've studied?
Hi. So the biggest butterfly. Well, you know, I worked with a group in Britain on a group of swallowtail butterflies from Africa, actually the largest swallowtail butterflies in Africa, and they're big. I mean, they're, you know, like this big. I've never actually studied directly those bird wings, which are even bigger, and I would love to do that, but they live too far away and nobody's asked me to help them yet. But I have worked to try to understand these African butterflies, and that's the story that I didn't include tonight because of time, and it seems that part of the way they produce color is using fluorescence, actually. They have a blue fluorescing pigment that seems to at least be somewhat important in their color. So that's probably the biggest one. But the small ones are cool too.
Why are the peacock spiders have the color on only this top of their butt?
We don't know. You know, because these things are so small, they've really been overlooked. Actually, up here, we're looking at two new species as of the past year, right? Yeah, completely unknown. Been in Australia in people's backyards for since before people had backyards in Australia, I suppose, right? So we don't know, and we don't know why they have the colors that they do. We don't know how well females can see those colors. I was talking with somebody before I started answering questions. One of the problems with jumping, which is not a problem, it is a problem for the male jumping spiders, is that female jumping spiders engage in something called sexual cannibalism, which is as bad as it sounds. It means that actually males are just as likely to get eaten as they are to mate with females. And so we're testing the idea that males, a lot of male colors in this group, may actually be an attempt to reduce female appetite, to try to convince females that they're not tasty, because they're using a lot of colors and a lot of patterns that we think are associated with toxic things in their environment. So maybe they're just trying to turn off the female's stomach and turn her on in other ways. So that's part of what we're trying to understand here. But really, I'm serious, we don't know. We don't know at all.
What's the smallest type of spider?
The smallest type of spider? I don't know. Yeah, I'm not really sure. These are pretty small. These are about as small as they get. But I would wager that there's probably smaller ones. But I mean, if they get much smaller, then they're really hard to study. I have a friend who studies mites, and you could just barely make them out without a microscope. And I don't know, one of the reasons why I decided not to study molecular biology or genetics exclusively is because I really have a hard time getting excited about things I can't see very well. So I really like things that are at least big enough that I can see them and kind of appreciate them as amazing little things. But that's just my own kind of personal taste. Hi.
As we are changing the genetic foundation of our plants, what are we doing to the insects?
That's a good question, and a fairly broad one. It's difficult to tell. The cabbage wight that I study is an agricultural pest, actually. And so it falls in the category of animals that might be affected by Roundup Ready or BT crops that might eventually express things that would kill this animal. I think it's worrisome to try to think about what the consequences might be that we haven't been able to foresee. I think that the potential for genetically modified crops is great, but also the risk. And so, when I was an undergraduate, I was working in the lab of a researcher whose wife was involved in the studies that first identified toxic effects of BT corn on monarch butterflies. And what they were able to show was that monarchs hadn't suddenly switched to eating corn. They were still eating milkweed, but they were oftentimes eating milkweed and next to fields that had this BT corn planted. And the BT, which is a toxin produced, a biological toxin that's produced by these genetically modified corn plants, was in the pollen too. And the pollen blew off the fields and onto the milkweed plants that these monarch caterpillars were eating. And so the monarch caterpillars ingested the toxin and ended up dying from it. And so those kinds of downstream effects are something that are a real concern for me. And some of where my research with collaborators is going is to try to understand how the changes that we are introducing into our environment are affecting the delicate balance that these animals have been using for a long time. So this is kind of a step away from the genetically modified plant question, but we are right now studying the effect of the amount of nitrogen fertilizers we dump on our fields every year on these cabbage white butterflies living in natural habitats that are now full of nitrogen. So it used to be that nitrogen was hard to come by, and it was a really great way to sift the wheat from the chaff in your male population. You could figure out who had the genes that were required for doing well in that environment. But as soon as you dump that limiting nutrient in large quantities into the riverways off of field runoff, suddenly everybody can be sexy. Right, everybody can get lots of nitrogen, and so it erodes the value of that signal for females. And we actually have some evidence that pre-World War II, before we started using nitrogen-based fertilizers to the extent that we are now, We see very strong patterns of larger males with more resources having more colorful wings in museum collections. Post-World War II, that pattern goes away or becomes much reduced. So it may be that just something like dumping too much fertilizer on our fields and having that wash downstream is having effects on these kinds of processes that I talked about today. So,
Two questions.
Uh-huh.
You'll see butterflies landing on a mud bank or something like that. What are they looking for? Nutrients, salt, moisture, or what?
It's mostly for salts and minerals. So because butterflies have this complex life cycle where they're really limited by what they get as caterpillars, and then they're adult, they don't eat anything as a pupa or a chrysalis. But then when they emerge as adults, they really only get sugar water, some amino acids in nectar, but very little. Some minerals in nectar, but very little. And so the behavior you're talking about, it's called puddling, is oftentimes in search of things like sodium, which is really important for brain function, as well as zinc and other salts and minerals that are important for maintaining their adult tissues. They also gravitate towards urine because that contains high levels of nitrogen-rich compounds, too. So they're really seeking out very specific things in that context.
Mm-hmm. The other one is, so with the... Do the wings actually fade after a period of time? And then you would, then a female would say, well, those wings are faded. He's a lot older. This last with gray hair. Same thing.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So the thing about these wing colors is that they're produced by wing scales, which are dead tissue. So they, and the wings are largely dead as well. So they can't make more of them as adults. So when they emerge as adult butterflies, that is the prettiest they'll ever be, right? Any butterfly collector will tell you that. They lose the scales, and I've looked at that a bit and trying to understand that. They don't lose them equally. Actually, the structural colored ones, I think partly because they're heavier and partly because they're more brittle, are much quicker to fall off the wings than the ones that don't have those large structures that produce color. Females do seem to pay attention to these changes in males. In a lot of animals, we think that females, there's good reason to believe that females should prefer older males because older males may have bigger territories. They may have more resources to offer. They may also have been able to persist in the face of predation and disease, and so maybe they've got genes that make them a better mate. That's not usually the argument in butterflies. In butterflies, older males are oftentimes disfavored, and the reason is because of the spermatophore. So males mate after they've mated. Their second spermatophore, their third spermatophore, their fourth spermatophore, there's diminishing returns there for females. They're able to produce smaller and smaller spermatophores, especially right after having mated with a female. And older males are more likely to have mated recently or mated multiple times. So females are less likely to get a large package of nutrients. So we see a strong bias towards young males in butterflies. So, bad news for... for older male butterflies.
Talking about the survival of the fittest, since certain butterflies have more nutrients for the female, what advantages in terms of strength? You say they fight territorial-wise. So, I mean, they don't have horns or anything, so do they battle, actually, and does the one with the biggest amount of nutrients to give to the female have an advantage in terms of, aside from color, and that attracts a female, but in terms of strength or intelligence or imagination?
Well, yes, they do. They fight without weaponry, right? So they can't really inflict harm on each other. And they are typically placed within a kind of the area of conflict resolution called wars of attrition, a siege being a war of attrition, or There's a lot of examples from human wars of this. Essentially, they try to outlast each other in aerial combat. And it's typically the male that has the most resources that wins. So in wars of attrition, the end of some kind of fight is typically determined by the loser giving up when they've run out of energy. It's costly for males to engage in these kinds of aerial disputes, and so males oftentimes pay attention to the other male's wing color or body size to try to figure out if it's worth picking a fight with the male. And so we do see that males that are more evenly matched in coloration or in body size typically are more likely to engage in fights and to persist in fights for longer because it's more difficult for them to decide ahead of time whether or not they might win or lose. So there's a whole class of theory, kind of conflict resolution theory that helps us to understand these kinds of things. I teach a class on animal communication, and that's a chunk of it is how do animals resolve conflict. And butterflies do it without actually injuring themselves, but just trying to outlast the other.
What about caterpillars? You said they're before the sexual stages, and is there a difference between males and females?
There are differences. One of the differences is that a lot of development of adult body structures occurs during the larval phase, during the caterpillar phase. So we are able to tell the difference between males and females in the caterpillar phase because we can see the male testes from outside of the butterfly.
Yeah.
You can see them through the outer surface of the caterpillar. Males oftentimes develop more rapidly, and so they have a slightly different metabolic rate, and they may oftentimes focus on different areas of the plant, although that's something that we haven't looked very carefully at yet. But males are under strong selection to emerge before other males to try to be kind of the first on the block, I suppose, something called protandry, and it's very common in insects for males to try to emerge first, and so that means they need to develop quickly. So there are big differences in that way. Differences in color, I can't really bring any to mind at the moment where there are really clear differences between males and females in the color of the caterpillars, but certainly all sorts of other aspects of their biology are different.
Just so quickly, putting the two questions together, how much is known about metamorphosis? It's such an amazing
Less than we'd like to admit. It's still a black box. It really is. I mean, we know a bit about how development is regulated hormonally. We do know a bit about how the body plan is laid down, but a lot of it is still a kind of a goop. It's difficult to figure out what's going on in there because things are being dissolved and built at the same time. So my student Ellie has been working very hard to try to understand how the female reproductive tract develops during the pupal stage. And there were a number of very challenging weeks where she said, I can't see anything in here. I can't find any structures in here. And she had to really train herself to identify these kind of nascent structures of the female reproductive tract in this goop. And so it's difficult. People are beginning to understand it better, and newer technologies and genetic technologies in particular are helping us to get a better grasp there. But it's still a bit of a black box. So,
When is their mating season, and how long is their gestation?
It depends on the species. You see the gamut of gestation. Some butterflies take a whole year to go from egg to adult, and they typically overwinter in one of their developmental stages. Some butterflies in really challenging habitats like the desert southwest can remain diapaused. It's kind of like a hibernation state for 9 or 10 years before they sense the right conditions to emerge in the spring. Other butterflies are a little bit more cavalier about it. So the cabbage whites, for instance, they're doing multiple generations a year. They're blowing through their life stages. They diapause as the chrysalis stage around here. They're out there mating right now. They're one of the first butterflies out right now. There's another butterfly out there called the mourning cloak, which overwinters as an adult and is one of the first adult butterflies you would see around here. And they're right at it. As soon as there are warm days, they're looking for females. Males are defending territories. So it really does depend on the butterfly species. There's a lot of variation in adult lifespan as well. One of the problems with being limited to getting protein just from your caterpillar stage is that you can't repair anything as an adult. So you get a muscle tear. You can't just repair that. And so that really limits adult lifespan. But there are those heliconius butterflies that were those mimetic butterflies I showed. They've actually have mechanisms for digesting pollen as adults. So they actually externally digest pollen on the tops of their heads. They spit out digestive enzymes. They slurp back up the digested proteins from the pollen. And those butterflies can live well over a year because they have a source of protein as adults. So there's big variation, anywhere from a couple of days to well over a year in the adult lifespan of butterflies as well.
You've been speaking about the entomology of butterflies.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever thought about the etymology of butterfly, whether that's from flying butter or permutation of flutterby, or there are, I think, some other ones? Have you ever delved into that and have an opinion?
I feel like the etymology, I have tried to collect the words for butterfly in different languages. My understanding, and this is the moment where you want to pull out your smartphone and look it up on Wikipedia, but my kind of mental construct for that is that one of the most common butterflies in Europe, where that term would have come from, is a cream color, and so it may have come from that particular species looking the color of butter. But this is being recorded, and I'm nervous about this being on the podcast, so that's not my final answer. I should know that. I'll come prepared next time.
For those of us who would like to do more research on that spider in the upper left-hand corner with the most complex eyes, will you repeat the name of it?
Well, most of these don't have common names, actually, but you have successfully picked out from this group here, the only one that lives in Pennsylvania. And that one is called Habronatus ciacatus. Habronatus. And then the species name is coecatus. That's the best I can do because they're not typically given common names. So.
Okay, thanks.
You can find them around here. And actually, there's I love them because I'm similarly strange. There's a community of people that love nothing more than to photograph these animals in particular because they are so fascinating and they do such amazing things. And so online, if you were to type that into Google, you will find a lot of pictures of this animal here from people who have rigged up all sorts of crazy camera equipment to get pictures of these things. So... Thomas Shahan, whose name is way over here, but you can't see it, he's one of those people, and he was the one that photographed this guy up here. So. They do have what are called androgens, so they do have male hormones. It's not exactly the same as testosterone. Two of the biggest hormones that we think a lot about here are something called ecdysone and juvenile hormone, and those do regulate development and another number of aspects of reproductive development in particular. So, it's probably a spring azure, and they're in a group called the Lycaenidae, or the blues, and they're particularly common early. They do also do that puddling behavior where they're looking for salts. And they're making those blue colors with complicated structures in their wing scales that are actually really quite similar to those complex air-filled structures in those two species of swallowtail. They're really neat. Males and females are different in color. We don't know anything about how they're selecting mates. But that's just for lack of trying, not lack of something interesting there. So those are pretty neat animals. And their caterpillars actually specialize predominantly on flowers. Kind of unusual in that group. That group has a lot of flower feeders that develop as caterpillars on flowers. And then a number of really remarkable examples where the caterpillars mimic the scent of queen ants and are carried in a big procession into the hive as if they're the queen and laid right next to the queen ant triumphantly. We found the queen. She was on a flower. What was she doing out there? And then fed as if she's the queen all the way through. But they lose the ability to smell like the queen when they become butterflies and they're underground and they're suddenly not the queen. And they have to race out of the ant colony before their wings harden, because they come out with soft wings, and so they scramble out of the ant colony to try to get loose. So it's kind of, why? How does nature think these things up? It's just totally demented sometimes, but fascinating. I made that completely up. It's not true. No, Google it. It's on Wikipedia, I'm sure.
We're at about 9 o'clock already, so we're going to wrap things up here. If you don't mind, let's thank Dr. Morehouse again for coming out tonight. We hope you enjoyed Cafe Sci this evening. Join us next month on June 3rd. Yes, you were paying attention to the slides. Drive safely. Have a good night.